begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for listening to the Flixwise podcast. I'm your host, Martyr for Love, Lady P, no relation to Master P. And joining me today is Flixwise co-producer, workaholic poet, Mr. Martin Kessler. Say hi, Martin.
Hello.
It will all make sense in a second.
Does that mean I'm the composer?
Well, I'm very pleased to welcome back to the show future cabinet minister's wife, Miss Anne Marie Kelly.
Oh, wait, that means I'm Gertrude.
You're Gertrude. On today's show, we are devoting ourselves completely and utterly to the 43rd greatest movie of all time, Carl Theodore Dreyer's 1964 feature, Gertrude. Yes, that's right. Mind, body, spirit, all for Gertrude. That is until we move on to our second topic, moving pictures. Moving pictures is the theme of this year's Turner Classic Movies Film Festival. We're going to talk very briefly about the fest, then we'll discuss some of the titles that we think are especially emotionally rousing. Finally, when our souls have been properly stirred, we're going to close things out with a few final notes of positivity. All right, guys, you ready to avoid each other's gaze for the next couple hours?
It's a big, sobering yes.
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 Yes. First up, we have Carl Theodore Dreyer's Gertrude, based on Hjalmar Söderberg's 1906 play called Gertrude. Gertrude is about a woman named Gertrude, go figure, played by Nina Penns Rode. Gertrude is a famous opera singer, but is now the stately wife of an ambitious politician named Gustav Canning. At the beginning of the film, Gustav tells Gertrude that she's about to become the wife of a cabinet minister, at which point Gertrude unceremoniously dumps Gustav and informs him that she's in love with someone else. They have a very polite discussion about the state of their relationship, with Gustav offering feeble protest and Gertrude remaining unfazed. The situation is emotionally fraught, but both parties remain composed and agree to keep up appearances, at least until Gustav's new position is secure. However, that doesn't stop Gertrude from running off to have a dalliance with her new lover, Erland Jansen, a young, dashing playboy who's a composer by trade, but occupies most of his time bar-hopping and skirt-chasing. In spite of his obvious personality flaws, Gertrude has fallen hopelessly in love with Erland. But before Gertrude can fully devote herself to the youngster, she has one of those pesky appearances to keep up. This one involves accompanying her husband to a ceremony honoring a native poet, Gabriel Lidman, who also happens to be one of Gertrude's former lovers, and you guessed it, is still mad about her. While at the ceremony, Gabriel tries his best to convince Gertrude that she should be with him instead of the no-good Nick Erland. But Gertrude remains steadfast, insisting that while they were together, Gabriel devoted entirely too much of his life to work and not enough to love. Poets in their long hours, what can you do? On top of those three, there's also Axel, the psychologist, with whom Gertrude shares a connection, though not necessarily a romantic one. Despite the steady stream of men that seem to flow towards Gertrude, in the end, she ends up alone. We flash forward to Gertrude as an elderly woman who's run away from all of her suitors, living alone in a house that's about as cozy as a bank vault, a martyr for the cause of love. Now that's what happens in the film, and the way I've described the events may not seem all that foreign. However, I've done the film a great disservice, because it is unusual, to say the least. The way that scenes are shot and blocked defy our basic understanding of the language of cinema. Characters are framed in long static two-shots, which are typically used to indicate closeness or intimacy. But here, even as characters deliver declarations of love or confess harsh truths about lingering resentments, the players seem detached from the scene and each other. The characters are staged and shot so that they appear to look just past each other as they're speaking. Despite the emotionalism at the film's core, the pacing and the arrhythmic dialogue delivery can be frustrating and alienating to many viewers. But why would Dreyer make a movie about love and passion that's laborious by design? Audiences at the time of the film's release were asking themselves this very question. In fact, when the film premiered in Paris, there was hissing from the crowd, and when it screened at Cannes, it was met with boos. The film was derided as a stodgy chamber piece, an unworthy addition to the Dreyer filmography. Obviously, critics have since come around on the film, since it's now listed as the 43rd greatest movie of all time on the Sight and Sound poll. Who's stodgy now, huh? But let's see if our panel is down with this reappraisal. So, who should I start with? Martin, how about you? How do you feel about Gertrude?
I like it.
Okay.
It's, like you said, a little bit difficult at first what to make of it. And I think when I was maybe 18 or 19 and first watching it, I didn't really find the sort of immediate artistic cachet that I had in Passion of Jeanne of Arc or Vampire or Day of Wrath. You can feel them sort of immediately. But I think with Gertrude, it's a little bit more elusive, the emotional power, the beauty of it. So I think it's grown on me, actually.
Okay, I like that. Anne, how about you?
I'm in much the same boat, so to speak. This is actually the first time I've seen it, but I watched it twice because I realized about 10 minutes in that this was going to, need, by virtue of the way it's constructed, be a movie that you need to watch multiple times to kind of get the multiple layers that are happening, because it is, by virtue of the way it's constructed, a difficult and multi-layered piece. It's not supposed to be something that you walk out of the theater and immediately go, ah, yes, of course. Clearly, Gertrude was thinking XYZ when she ran off with the psychologist. Or ran off next to the psychologist, yeah. Or ran off...
Went to be neighbors with the psychologist, yeah.
Obviously, plot points aside, there's a lot of ambiguity. It's a movie... I was doing a little bit of research, and Dreyer said that he was trying to make a movie where the dialogue was more important than the image. And while I don't think that's necessarily true of how the movie functions, just by virtue of Dreyer being, since he was such a great silent film director... a director who is very married to image. The way he uses image in this movie is very difficult and very complex. And like you pointed out, Lady P, not conventional to how we think of as quote unquote cinematic.
Yeah.
So it's a movie that requires attention. And I'm glad that I spent 4 hours. I'm glad that I spent 4 hours watching it twice, but my goodness, it was a long 4 hours. Dreyer could not get Dreyer.
Hey! I mean, I think out of the three of us, I think I like this the least. I found this film really frustrating. I think in large part for personal reasons, which are that it reminded me of stuff that I used to make in film school.
Oh, no.
It really... well, it's just the way he shoots people in profile and the way the dialogue is shot, and it really, like, the basic aesthetic of it really, really reminded me of these scenes that I would put together in film school. And I'm like, if I can do it, it must not be great.
But I think that's maybe a little bit deliberate. I think yeah. To show passion, it sort of makes sense that Gertrude's in this sort of suffocatingly dull world. I think it's sort of a deliberate aesthetic choice.
I don't actually think it's dull. I think it's fascinating. Especially some moments are dull. but it finally, like, he has that really long static take where Gertrude and Gabriel are reminiscing about their relationship and why it didn't work out. And I thought that scene was just riveting. And many scenes like it are riveting. It's more just that on the surface, it may appear it's the
stayed.
Pacing is slow. Yeah, stayed. It does kind of feel stayed and airless. But I think maybe it is just that it's airless. Maybe that's more the issue is that, like, I don't know.
But is that the world of the film or is that the film itself? And
I think
not
it's
sure.
I think it's both, and I think it's both by design. I mean, if you look at Dreyer, and if the only two Dreyer films that you know are Passion of Joan of Arc and Vampire, then you're going to be looking at this film going, how from where we started did
yeah.
we end up here? Because Vampire and Joan of Arc are both movies that use fast cuts and fast cutting. And if you mm-hmm. look at the time the movie was made, the time Gertrude was made, it's in the middle of the French New Wave. It's in the middle of the beginnings of the New Wave, where jump cuts are really in, and a lot of kind of very showy, formalistic devices are becoming really popular. So it's understandable that, especially compared to that backdrop, you're sitting there going, why are we just staring at two people not staring at each other in a living room for 9 minutes straight while the camera doesn't move? But I think that's, I mean, I don't think that. I know that that's the point of it. What Dreyer does in his films so well, whether it's this very surreal vampire, whether it's the heartbreaking Passion of Joan of Arc, or whether it's this, is that he builds the tone of the scene into the film. Like, you can't separate that question that we were saying, is the movie staid, or is the situation airless? It's both. And that's by virtue of design. He makes the movie feel claustrophobic for that entire first scene for so long that when you open up to the to her first meeting with her lover, with the composer, and it's suddenly outside, it's like a shock to the system. Mm-hmm. He is a director who, I'm going to keep harping on this because I love that he's a silent film director and he's one of my favorite silent film directors. He marries form to function a lot. So if he wants you to feel airless, he's not going to move the camera. If he wants you to feel free, he's suddenly going to throw you outside and overexpose the image so that it suddenly feels very bright. And I think that that's what we're reacting to as much as anything, is that he decided to make a doll's house and make it as claustrophobic as possible.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I think too. Well, it's also interesting, like, the context that Dreyer came out of as a filmmaker. That golden age of Danish cinema. You think of those very static shots, the stateliness of those films. And I think in this film, the period that Gertrude is set in, Dreyer would have been about the same age as the young guys who come in marching and say, "Oh, you old people, you're all about logic. Mm-hmm. What about love and passion?" And I sort of wondered if maybe it was Dreyer considering what he was, to a certain extent, rebelling against by having the sort of fast cutting of Passion of Joan of Arc, or the moving fast camera work that you see in Vampire, stuff like that. I think maybe part of it's a little bit his a filmmaker looking back on their beginnings, their origins. Yeah.
Absolutely. It does. It absolutely feels like, what do they call that kind of genre? The old man's film, the great old man's film, something like Limelight. Well, no, it's his last film. And he made it about 4 years before he died. And there was a 9-year period of time between this and his previous film. And it is. It's going back to his own childhood. It's going back to his own youth. And it is, I think, I don't think you would be amiss to say that he feels for Gertrude's sense of being stifled by the situation that she's in. I think that's absolutely accurate. There was a wonderful, I think it's Andrew Saris wrote this great review of it, saying that it's a movie looking at passion as a man who has one foot in the grave, or something like that.
I mean, it's true. And I think like when I watched this film as a teenager, it was like, that was a fault of the film. And now that maybe I'm getting a little bit older, it's it becomes a virtue of the film.
Mm-hmm.
It's something you do see, like you said, in a lot of filmmakers' final films. You know, you think of Ozu's last film, or, I mean, there's a bunch you could probably lump together, but that's reflecting back on life. I think there's even a line in Gertrude where she says, "Oh, looking back on my life, it's like her memories are like a fire waiting to be extinguished." It's that melancholy and reflection.
Right. I mean, I guess my problem is, like, I know Dreyer is a master, obviously, and everything he does is intentional. He'd been making movies for quite a while at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess my issue is some of the choices just don't work for me, or maybe some of the limitations of the actors are a problem. I'm not sure if it was a directorial choice or if that was just kind of what the actors were capable of, but for me, the lead actress, Nina Rhodes, I just kind of feel like she's miscast.
Oh, Dem's fighting words.
I completely disagree.
Dem's fighting words.
Really?
Oh, God, yeah. I think she's phenomenal.
Because I feel, the problem is, like, you get into how would I cast the film. I'm Lady P, he's Carl Theodore Dreyer, like, who the hell cares, right? But, like, what this film kind of brought to mind for me was Jules and Jim.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, I kind of wanted some of that earthiness, the, like, world weariness of Jean Monroe. And what she's doing is she's doing something very different. And I'm sure a part of it is like the dialogue, you know, they don't really converse. They recite the dialogue as if they're reciting poetry, mm-hmm. you know. They're delivering a sermon or not even their
eulogy.
A eulogy, yeah. They are. It's very somber. So maybe I was just kind of off-putting for me, or maybe it defied my expectations in a way that made me uncomfortable. I don't know.
I mean, a lot of the film does make me feel uncomfortable, but like I think, mm-hmm. like the for instance, the delivery of the dialogue, like it's, I think especially somebody coming out of silent film would understand that acting is more than just the delivery of the dialogue. And even though the dialogue has this sort of flatness to it, I feel like there's so much going on under the surface in her performance.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. I get. Obviously, you two think so.
And well, it's also the dialogue is what makes it feel the most new wave-y. It's not a film that I would in any way classify as a new wave film, but it is the part that feels the most like it. If you think of something like Godard's Contempt, where they're entirely talking about the relationship and not looking at each other, or even though he's not technically part of the new wave, Ingmar Bergman's Persona. It's there, you can see a lot of kind of threads through of a similar kind of that. This might have just been a 60s thing. Everybody really likes extemporizing while not looking at each other. Even Agnes Varda's first film is full of this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So it's not even like he's reinventing the wheel on this particular mode of address. It's a fairly common one at the time. But I want to go back to what you were saying about wanting her to be a little bit more world-weary, mm-hmm. is what you said. And I think that's interesting because the way that I took Gertrude's character was less of a woman dissatisfied with her life because she's seen too much, less of a cynical character and more of an idealist. She has this idea of what love should be. And every single lover she has, whether it's her husband, the composer, the poet, not the psychologist, she puts that man on a pedestal and waits for him to reach that point. When he doesn't, she knocks him off and moves to the next one. And I don't think the film criticizes her for that necessarily. I mean, it kind of presents her as a when we catch up to her at the end, and she's still very content with how her life turned out, even though she's alone. I think it's a film that kind of examines that isolating idealism if you're looking for this specific kind of love, and shows the way that actually idealized love can be, instead of romantic or sweet or messy, it can actually just be isolating, mm-hmm. and can be something that does leave you alone. And I thought that was kind of fascinating for it. Part of it is also to the way she's framed and the way she's lit. Everybody else will be lit relatively normally, not mm-hmm. normally. There's nothing about this movie.
She's luminous. Yeah.
She's luminous. Yeah. She's lit from the eyes consistently with a backlight to give her a halo as well. Like she's lit. She is lit more beatifically than Joan of Arc was in the Passion of Joan of Arc. Joan of Arc was a saint. Mm-hmm. So you can really see Gertrude kind of existing as this, for herself, patron saint of love. But it is a very specific and ultimately maybe not productive kind of love.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, the word love gets bandied about a lot in this film, but I mean, as we talked about, this is Dreyer's last film, and it's interesting that, Paul Schrader kind of lumped him in with the other transcendental mm-hmm. stylist, Ozu and Rasson, and in that they're both, they all make, presumably, according to Schrader, films about spirituality, and obviously, a lot of Dreyer's other films are explicitly about religion and both how oppressive it can be and how, but also about just having a higher calling and the power of God. And I mean, I'm thinking obviously of Ordet.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And he had talked for years about making a movie about the life of Jesus Christ and never got it off the ground. So yeah, absolutely.
Right. But in this film, it's about love and the power of love. Now, is love, do you guys think the love is a euphemism for God, or is it not quite that simple? Or
well, it's I mean, it's interesting when the musician's saying, oh, do you believe in God? And Gertrude kind of hints that maybe she doesn't, and he said, well, there must be some higher power. And I think what the film ends up doing, even if it's not using it as a synonym, it's at least equating that love is the higher power, that idealism is a higher power, and the passion for it, it's I don't know. Like, I think you can watch this film without feeling like you've had a religious experience, but at the same time, you sort of think of the martyrdom, the striving for some higher power, and I think it does fit in with his more religious works.
Yeah. Yeah, in that way, I definitely agree. Certainly Gertrude sees herself as a, not necessarily a martyr for love, but certainly an advocate for it in a very spiritual sense. And I think each of the men in her life sees love differently. I mean, the composer is very hedonistic in the way that he sees love. The poet is slightly closer to her definition by virtue of being very poetic about it. And she quotes him at him at one point, and he says, yeah, that does sound like something I'd say. And the politician is very grounded. So she's presented with three different types of love, but none of them is the same as hers, and so she rejects it. But it's important to note that, like, she seems perfectly content having rejected all of these. Like, even if she doesn't reach her ideal, she is perfectly happy to, you know, serve it for the rest of her life.
Well, sure, she'd be, I think, much less happy if she ended up with a self-important, passive-aggressive schlub.
Yeah.
Just for example. Yeah, exactly. And so I think it's a weird kind of feminist moment of the movie, too, is that, like, Gertrude just kind of does whatever she wants, and all of the men allow her to do so, even though it's set in, like, 1906 or 1907. Mm-hmm. So, like, power to you, Gertrude.
Yeah.
But it's kind of going into this concept of love not as a connection between two people, but as a spiritual mode of transcendence, to kind of bring it back to the transcendentalist thing. So I do think it absolutely fits in that. Mm-hmm. And it's, I don't know, I usually I have a lot of difficulty stomaching these, like, high proclamations of love, but just because we spend so much time, like, debating it, really, I mean, it is a lot of people talking about their relationships, but it does in a lot of ways seem like a debate, as they're just sitting there discussing what went wrong, and you can see that they're not communicating in any real way. Mm-hmm. I mean, see that because they're not looking at each other, but also see that because they're not listening to each other. So it does, in a lot of ways, just feel like a debate on what does love mean.
Mm-hmm. And in the end, we, as you've said, she ends up alone. But the film ends with a kind of an epilogue that I believe Dreyer wrote himself. It wasn't in the original play. Mm-hmm. And the psychologist Axel comes to visit. Now, what is the significance of having the psychologist at the end, who's ultimately the one that she communicates best with?
Yeah, I have a theory about this that mostly just goes back to how much I hate how psychology is used in films in the 60s in general. mostly I'm thinking about Marnie and Hitchcock.
Well, yeah.
Which is, like, how do you get from Hitchcock to Dreyer?
Easily, it turns out.
Very easily. Which just seems to be that, like, I like that Axel exists in that he's the one, like, male presence in her life that she doesn't explicitly go after with romantic zeal. And I do find it fascinating that after she rejects three guys, she's like, I'm going to become a psychologist. And, like, you're the most unrealistic, like, your ideas of how emotion works are the most unrealistic of all three, but sure, go for it, become a psychologist. Let's see how that works. But Axel does seem to function. I don't know. I would love to hear what you guys think on this, because I feel like the becoming a psychologist bit and the Axel coming in at the end in the epilogue bit functions on in terms of her character is showing that she's kind of fine with her martyrdom, but also functions as, like, this weird, it's supposed to be a grounding situation, like, well, she's a psychologist now, so she understands the workings of the human mind, even though that's not at all how psychology works.
Yeah.
But I would love to hear your thoughts on it, because that's the part of the movie that actually confuses me the most.
Yeah, I mean, I think it kind of cements the point that she's talking about love in this very abstract way that has very little to do with human emotion, in that, so we have this psychologist who studies human emotion, right? And this is sort of her transcending the hormones and
psychological.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. This is her bidding adieu. Like, this, she's on a higher plane at this point.
I like that. So she turns down hedonistic love. She turns down poetic love. She turns down I was going to say political love, but that's not it. We'll call it pragmatic love. Yeah. And then she turns down the psychological definition of love. So she has her own. I like that. I completely will buy that.
Sold.
Sold. Absolutely.
I like it too. Okay. Well, is there anything else we wanted to add before we ask the final question?
I thought this was going to be a take a drink every time I say Lars von Trier episode, but it turned out it wasn't.
We didn't say it once. We can say this is Lars von Trier's favorite movie.
Well, actually, you know which film this reminded me a lot of, since I always like to squeeze this in, is Andrei Tarkovsky's Mirror. There's the long camera moves in that, the very sort of careful choreography, even, the shot in Gertrude where she's reflected in the mirror and there's all these mirrors in it. Sort of got the impression that maybe this was a major influence on Tarkovsky's Mirror.
I'm just thinking, we've talked Godard, Tarkovsky, Bergman, Bresson. Like, we're hitting Lars von Trier now. We've hit all of them. Like, good Lord. We've
Hitchcock.
Hit most of our auteurs. Hitchcock, This is the auteur-heavy episode. Yes. There is one thing. We haven't really talked. We touched on it a little bit in terms of lighting, but I do think it's important to point out, since we did talk endlessly about how kind of static the camera is, that this, in terms of, like, it is an absolutely static camera, but it does show off one thing that I think is really important about Dreyer's filmography, which is that he was a master of mise-en-scène and of staging for the camera. Where he places people in the shots tends to be extremely important, and how he places them facing each other or not. People talk constantly when they're talking about Passion of Joan of Arc of how shallow the framing is for Joan. She's up against that white background, and so she seems completely smashed up against the camera almost. But in this one, the shot that actually surprised me the most, and would probably be if we were doing like a best shot, would not be the 9-minute long conversation, although I think that's brilliant and really well done. It's actually the shot of the mirror, the poet's mirror, before the poet's even introduced. She's talking about how he had told her she should always put it in the bedroom. And it's framed as the mirror against this blank wall. It's a very shallow frame. But through the mirror, you can see Gertrude and the entire room in shadow behind her. So you have this simultaneously very shallow frame and this very deep frame behind Gertrude reflected in the mirror, so that you get this, like, this dual situation. And I think it speaks kind of to the theme of the movie of, at first it looks like it's a very shallow kind of surface thing, but there's actually all of this depth to it, to the characters. You just need to keep peering in farther.
One last thing before I ask the final question, Martin.
Okay.
Does it not end with bells? I thought I heard bells. Yet another movie. Are we keeping a tally?
Somebody should.
I'm going to go with like half of the movies on this list.
Keeping track of all the bells in the films, please let us know.
Yes. All great films end in bells.
Mm-hmm.
That's our working
theory. Or with
theory.
A door slam. It's the door slam heard around the world between A Doll's House and Godfather.
Yeah. I like that. All right, last question. This is the 43rd movie on the Sight and Sound list. Is this question getting more and more fun, right?
I feel like every time you ask this question, I always ask the next question, which is, what else is on the list?
Okay, I forgot to write this down, but it is tied with a whole bunch of other things. We have Close Up, we have Some Like It Hot, we have Parole Fou. Please don't make me say that again.
Interesting.
Playtime, I think. So.
Yeah, I would put it up there with those. I mean, it's just by virtue of adding such, like, interesting color to that list. I would happily put
43 is all right. Okay, yeah. Martin.
Yeah, I think 43 is probably a good place for it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I will actually say, even though I'm not supposed to say this, that I like it better than Vampire.
Okay. Wow.
You know what? I like this better than Odette. No, it is.
You like it better than Odette?
Oh.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh my gosh. Martin, this might be the end.
Never again. Get out.
This might be your end of your friendship with Lady P. The look that she gave you, I cannot accurately describe.
That was surprise. Wow. Better than Odette. Okay. Fair enough. All right. I guess my issue with having this film so high is the same issue I have with putting four Jean-Luc Godard films in the top 50. Like, we've already had two Dreyer films, and we have not had one Howard Hawks film.
Yeah, that is the problem with an auteur-heavy focus. Wouldn't it be interesting if you told the Sight and Sound poll folks that they could only put, like, maximum two films by each director on the list?
Mm-hmm.
I really, just by virtue of the list being so, like, auteur-obsessed, like you said, four Godard films in the top 100, which is insane. I think it would be, 50. Or in the top 50, and don't get me wrong, I like Godard, but, like...
They're not that good. Come on now.
Everybody's got limits.
And it's not even his best movies in the top.
Well, because it, because you knock out the films by the people who don't have large filmographies. You knock out the Tuki Bukis of the world, and you knock out, you know, those. So I think it would be fascinating if you're like, two tops, maybe only one. Exactly. I think you'd really see a radical change in how the list gets, how the list functions.
Yeah. Well, next time, 2020.
Yes. Oh, I have one more point to make. Since we've been talking about him a lot, and because, fine. We were talking about how this was a controversial movie at the time it was released, but Cahiers du Cinéma listed it as number two that year, and Godard actually said it was his favorite film of
that
year.
That's true.
And I put absolutely no stock in anything Godard likes, but it's important to point out that everybody...
not everybody hated it.
Not everybody hated it. Sorry, I'm not a Brechtian Marxist who likes to make racist statements about the Vietnam War. My bad. And now we know why I've only reviewed one of the Godard movies on this podcast.
Oh, you are coming back. We got how do you say it, Martin?
Histoire du cinéma.
Really? Okay,
it's coming up.
You're
very soon.
You're not getting me on that one.
Yeah. Within you, dies, don't you want somebody to love? Don't you need somebody to... Next up, we're going to talk about our favorite moving pictures, which of course will be completely different from our previous discussion on tearjerkers. Yep, separate topics entirely.
The sarcasm is thick. The sarcasm is thick.
Okay, so maybe there's some overlap. But the reason we're discussing moving pictures is because it's the theme of this year's TCM Film Fest, which takes place in Los Angeles from April 28th through May 1st. And there is definitely some overlap between our listenership and TCM fans. So let's talk a little bit about TCM for a bit, and then we'll discuss how we might program a series called Moving Pictures. So I'm going to start with Anne, because she's the first, she's the only one of the three of us who's actually been to TCM Fest. And we're all very jealous.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So so maybe you can, like, give people a primer. What is TCM Fest, and why should they show up?
So TCM Fest takes place usually around the middle or end of April every year. It is a film festival that, unlike most Hollywood film festivals, is entirely devoted to classic film, depending on what your definition of classic film is, which is a controversy we'll get into in a second. It's run by Turner Classic Movies, and it is, I think, really and truly the most fan-friendly film festival I've ever been to, because it takes place over like 4 or 5 days on Hollywood Boulevard. You go inside El Capitan Theater, Grumman's Chinese, or TCL Chinese, The Egyptian, and TCM really works to make the fan experience of these classic movies that you'd usually only be able to see on your TV, but can now see as they were originally planned in, you know, glorious Technicolor on the big screen, or glorious black and white, depending on the film. It's really the only chance some classic film fans ever really get to see these films as they're supposed to be seen. And it's also just kind of a fun opportunity to get to meet other TCM fans. TCM works really hard on getting the fans to communicate with each other. TCM party becomes really big there, which is a hashtag on Twitter, usually just devoted to watching the movies on TV. And on top of that, it ends up being kind of a good primer for what's coming out from the various studios and Criterion over the course of the year. Like Hard Day's Night, before it was on Criterion, they debuted it at TCM Film Festival. So if you've never seen A Hard Day's Night on the big screen, I did in surround sound, which it shouldn't have been, but that's a separate issue. at Grumman's Chinese Theater. So it's a really, it's not a film festival like TIFF or like AFI Fest. It's truly its own beast, and it is an absolute blast.
We should be clear. We are not in any way affiliated with Turner Classic Movies, though I wish we were. former or guest, hopefully future guest and former guest, Mariah Gates, now works for TCM, but that's about as close of an association as we have. Mm-hmm. Not getting paid for this plug, so
nope.
Just doing this because we love Turner Classic Movies.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, you touched on the idea that, like, how do you even begin to decide what constitutes a classic film? Mm-hmm. And the list of movies that they're showing, while presumably all kind of coalesce around this theme of moving pictures, kind of, maybe. But, like, how, in terms of movie history, where is the cutoff? Where, at what point does a film become classic?
That's a great question, and I don't think it's one that we've answered very distinctly. One of the things that I really like about TCM, actually, is that they take a broad idea for it, so it's not just going to be what you think of when you think of quote-unquote classical Hollywood cinema, because that would really only be what studio system from, like, the beginning of the code to, well, really the end of the code, the studio system era. So that would only be about 30 years of history. Instead, TCM is showing silent movies. Actually, they're showing Passion of Joan of Arc, but we'll get into that in a minute. They show silent movies from the early 20s, and not just Hollywood films, but also international films as well. So they're really focusing on bringing as much film history as they can, even if that's recent film history. And because TCM's goal is always kind of to augment the experience, they'll also bring in people associated with the films as well.
Mm-hmm.
If they're still alive. Obviously, Carl Theodore Dreyer is not around to talk about Passion of Joan of Arc. But most of the cast and crew of Boys in the Hood is. So they really try to pull in folks. Last year, when I saw The Children's Hour, Shirley MacLaine was there to talk about filming The Children's Hour. They also pull in people who are classic fans, too. So Anna Kendrick introduced the women at one point, which actually ended up being surprisingly delightful. She can quote the movie just offhand, which is fantastic. So it's really a big and broad range of film, and it's an exciting opportunity for anybody who considers themselves a movie geek. You don't even need to be a movie history geek to like it.
All right, well, I'm convinced I need to go.
Mm-hmm.
But let's get to the theme this year, moving pictures. So let's try and distinguish between moving a moving picture and a tearjerker. There is a distinction, right? Martin?
Sure. I think there's some overlap of tearjerkers that are moving films, but when I think of a moving film, I usually think how a film's strength isn't in explaining an idea or a theme, it's in making you feel an idea or a theme. So I think moving pictures are the ones that you know, dig for the deep emotions that you don't get every day, or reconcile contradictory truths, or go for the big catharses, the big inspirations, the big tragedies, you know, love, death, justice, freedom, self-sacrifice, goodness. But like, not necessarily to say it's going to be big on the screen. In fact, sometimes I think maybe the more understated or veiled in the aesthetics of the film, the better it might be. So,
And?
Okay, I went in a completely different direction with this.
Perfect.
Mostly just because it's very hard to define what a moving picture is. I think it changes based on your taste. But I was also thinking of moving pictures just in terms of motion.
Mm-hmm. And so not La Chate, is that like
it? Not La Chate, but maybe The French Connection.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
You know, not The Long Goodbye, but maybe The Great Train Robbery.
Yeah.
Yeah, not Mrs. Miniver, but maybe The Italian Job.
Mm-hmm.
The original, not the remake, although the remake's great too.
Your favorite moving pictures, you cheater! So, La Jete works for you, Martin. Perhaps that is a moving picture, but in the classic sense, absolutely not. Literally still images. Otherwise, just about that encompasses just about everything. But I like that. So, but we've also done an episode on best chase scenes. So,
I mean, if you want to get really awful about it, we could be talking about it as pictures that move, the true original, like 35mm, 8mm, 16mm mm-hmm. small snapshots that are placed in front of the camera in rapid succession and mm-hmm. make you believe that there is motion on screen.
Mm-hmm. Thank
and
you.
Therefore, you're welcome.
The and horse is moving.
Yes, thank you, Edvard, whatever his name was.
Muybridge, yeah.
Muybridge.
There's a giant statue of Matt outside USC. Anyway, I'll come to the USC campus sometime. I'll show mm-hmm. it to you. But yes, in terms of the Edward Muybridge definition of moving pictures, then really anything you screen in 35mm mm-hmm. is a moving picture.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the Quentin Tarantino definition of a moving picture. We're just going to drop that thread right there and not take it back up again.
Okay, well, which way should we take this topic now that you've thrown a monkey wrench into things, right? I mean, when I think of a moving picture, I think of something that stirs my soul. Mm-hmm. But not necessarily, but I do want to distinguish it from Tearjerker, because I think that there are certain things that will elicit a kind of a... I don't know, it's almost like pulling nose hairs kind of reaction. Like, I know what you're doing. This is cheating. You know what I mean?
Do people pull your nose hairs?
All the time.
This conversation has gotten so weird.
Yeah. But because I do feel like a lot of the time, tearjerkers can be manipulative. Like, I feel like it's like you're pinching me, to use people don't often pinch me either, I guess. Or when
this conversation is derailing rapidly.
It's chopping onions.
I know, it's going
through. Where did all of these onions come from?
It's true. I think Martin, I think you're right in that, like, a true moving picture is something maybe that aims. Not necessarily. Its aim isn't necessarily to make you cry, but just to, I don't want to, see,
inspire,
I don't even know.
Some can inspire you,
sure,
they don't necessarily
yeah.
make you cry. I mean,
exactly.
It's those films you
like,
feel
yeah.
in your chest. Yeah,
yeah, exactly, yeah.
And that transitions very nicely mm-hmm. into the movies that TCM Film Festival has chosen this year, because it is kind of, it does run the gamut, really, in terms of types of movies. You've got, you know, nostalgic classics like The King and I mm-hmm. and The Kid.
Mm-hmm.
You've got religious fervor dramas like Passion of Joan of Arc. Have, you know, the more cynical but thought-provoking movies like The Long Goodbye and The President's Men and MASH. You've got melodramas like Shanghai Express, really nostalgia-laden movies like The Endless Summer. Mm-hmm. They really, really picked a wide variety of film.
Mm-hmm. When they first announced the lineup, it was like they had Children of a Lesser God on there. They mm-hmm. had Passion of Joan of Arc.
Mm-hmm.
They had Endless Summer. And I was like, all right, I see where you're going with this. Mm-hmm. And then as they've slowly started adding other things, I was like...
A Tree Grows in Brooklyn.
Yeah, A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, absolutely.
Yeah.
And then when they start adding in Band of Outsiders, all right, you just got Anna Karina and you need an excuse to program it. That's totally cool.
Yep.
Totally, totally cool. But it does, you know... As we say, moving pictures, that encompasses a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So
if they put I Remember Mama in, I would have been wrecked.
Mm-hmm.
There's a movie that never fails to make me sob.
Okay. Well, you weren't on our Tearjerker episode, so I feel like you should probably tell us. Yeah. What are some movies that make you cry? Yeah.
Absolutely and totally. I Remember Mama. And because my mom's side of the family is Norwegian, mm-hmm. and my grandmother used to tell stories about, like, getting her first cup of coffee by holding a cube of sugar between her teeth to drink it so it would sweeten it. Like, you want to see my entire family cry, you put on that movie. You put on that scene in that movie. So, yes, that is a movie that makes me sob uncontrollably. The ending of City Lights makes me cry.
Yes.
But that's just because Chaplin is a master manipulator.
Yes, he is. Tom. That bastard.
I mean, it really just like put on the end of a Chaplin movie, like mm-hmm. The Kid, which they're showing, mm-hmm. You're going to make most of the audience sob.
Yeah. But City Lights, that one, brutal.
Yep. Yep.
And but then... I don't know, because sometimes, sorry to interrupt you, but like movies are really sad, but they don't necessarily make me cry.
A movie that I will never cry at, and I actually get extremely ticked off at, that everybody thinks is a great classic, Affair to Remember. That movie ticks me off so much. Like, all she needed to do was pick up the phone and be like, hey, I meant to show up, but I got hit by a taxi. Mm-hmm. That is it. That completely eliminates your third act.
It's true. It's true. But I do love Love Story. The Irene Dunbar.
Oh, okay. Give me a look. Okay. Yeah. I thought you were talking about Love Story.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Love means never how to say.
Oh, God, no. Right, goodness no. gracious. No, no. No, the 1939. Yeah, yeah. Am I right? It's called Love Story, right? Is it?
Love Affair.
Love Affair. Thank you, thank you. Yeah, I like that version. Mostly because Irene
Dunn. I like the last one because Katharine Hepburn is in it, and it's their second to last movie.
I have not seen that.
And that fact makes me cry. The yeah. movie itself is, again, all you need to do is pick up a phone and say I got hit by a taxi. That's it.
It's true.
The more obviously emotionally manipulative movies. Oh, also is it The Awful Truth? What's the movie with Irene Dunne and Cary Grant where mm-hmm. they adopt the kid?
Oh, no.
That's not The Awful Truth. That's
the Heaven one?
I don't remember what the name of it is. That one, mostly Irene Dunne. She seems to kind of pop up in movies that make me cry.
Brutal.
Or laugh hysterically, because The Awful really Truth, funny. Which is the bigamy movie, is the really funny one.
Mm-hmm. The Awful Truth.
And what's another movie that makes me cry?
Well, It's a Wonderful Life never fails.
No. And that, oh my God, no.
Are you kidding?
No, that movie does not make me cry.
That movie makes me sob every single
time. Frank Capra is such a little political and emotional manipulator.
Yes, he is.
No.
Yes.
No part of Frank Capra movies makes me cry. The ending of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington does not make me cry. The ending of...
But he's not licked, Anne.
You think that's perfectly fine. Good for him. The political system is not going to reform itself just because he yelled in Congress for 3 hours. Like, sorry, that's not how the American justice system works. I don't care if he saw the light from the Lincoln Memorial. I'm too cynical for King Frank Capra movies.
I don't believe this, you monster.
It's a Wonderful Life is a depressing movie. It's a movie about a guy who almost commits suicide. Like, there is nothing about that makes me want to cry tears of joy.
Don't tell about this.
Well, I will spare you my thoughts because listeners have already heard them because we did a Flix Boys Favorites episode.
This is why I'm not on the tearjerker episode because I'm too cynical for this. Just kind of like even Bambi's mom doesn't make me cry. Like,
do it.
Bambi's a deer. He's low on the food chain. Sorry, bro. Like, mom tasted good with dinner.
Ouch. I don't know, but I think I'm on the record as being pretty heartless, because I think Grave of the Fireflies doesn't make me cry, which is probably the most depressing movie of all time.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, it's almost too depressing. I'm like, stop it. I can't with this.
Yeah, there are those movies that end up getting so, like, emotionally abusive, almost. Mm-hmm. Like, those movies that are so extremely rough that just, like, part of your brain shuts off.
Mm-hmm.
Like, The Heart is a Lonely Hunter is an incredibly depressing movie, but it's not one that makes me cry because, like, midway through, I'm like, I know where this is going, and I'm not here for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, just so listeners are clear, It's a Wonderful Life is screening at this year's Turner Classic Club.
Yep, and guess where I will be? Yeah. Not there.
Not
actually,
there, apparently.
It's entirely possible that I will have to go. I'm setting up a poll this year I write for The Film Experience. That's
by the way.
Plug.
Yeah.
If you go on The Film Experience about the week before TCM Film Festival, so the middle of April, I'm going to be polling people about what movies they want me to be at and what things they want me to write about. So there is a distinct possibility that even though I do not want to write about it, I will still be at the It's a Wonderful Life screen.
I mean, even if it doesn't make you cry, I still think it's a really interesting movie. Like, I don't think it's treacly in the way that it's been represented. I think it's a really dark movie.
I just find all Capricorn to be treacly.
Ouch. What about It Happened One Night?
Okay, It Happened One Night is not treacly, and it is saved from treacliness by its two leads, who clearly did not want to be there, but were having a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love lots of Capra, so, but we'll get into it. We can fight about it later. Mm-hmm. but yeah, Martin, any, I know we, not tearjerkers, because we've already talked about that, but if you want to talk about other movies that move you.
Sure.
And if they should, like, let's do ones that are moving, but do not make you cry.
Some filmmakers seem to have a knack for that. Like, I mean, we talked about Andrei Rublev. That's a film I find very moving. Mm-hmm. That doesn't make me cry. I think Terrence Malick, his more recent films, I find them very moving, even if they're not sort of tearjerkery. Like, To the Wonder, I found that film very moving. I think partly because it just feels so personal and can kind of connect with the immigrant experience sort of part of the story. A lot of Kim Ki-duk's films. I don't know if you've seen Three Iron or Spring, Summer, Fall, Winter, and Spring Again.
I have not.
I haven't.
I think he's like a master dramatist, very empathetic, very challenging films. I'd recommend people check them out. There's a film called Mulade by Ousmane Sembini, who I think probably people mostly know Xala and Black Girl, but this was his last film, and I was thinking actually it has certain things in common with Gertrude, since it was his last film, and it's also sort of about uncompromising women, and that's a very moving film.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
Yeah, cool.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen Jericho with Paul Robeson?
Mm-hmm. I have
not. Oh my god, when he's singing My Way on the top of the sand dune, like, I think that's a really moving film, and you sort of feel like any other movie at that time would just like punish that character just for being himself, and he kind of has it his own way, and in the end, like, it's so liberating at the end when maybe I shouldn't spoil the ending, but it's
Robeson's such a powerful force too. Robeson's such a powerful force in that movie.
Yeah, it's like his singing voice, his on-screen presence, like, he's so powerful, he can project emotion in such an exciting way. I don't think he ever directed any of his own films, but he always had sort of a certain creative control over his image and his projects. And I think that's a really moving film.
Mm-hmm.
What else? Mikhail Kalatozov's films, like Letter Never Sent or The Cranes Are Flying, I'm Cuba. Like, I find those moving in such an aesthetic way, the way he shoots nature, the way he shoots people, something about it always really speaks to me. And
I've never heard of any of those films.
Mm-hmm.
You're pretty good, Martin.
I mean, there's a few like obvious ones too, like like Spartacus, I find very moving. Like, I think any That's film fair. About freedom, like, just yeah. partly because of my background and my parents, I find most films about freedom, you know, even at like a huge cost, being worth it, to be very moving. Whether it's
Give us free.
Give us us. I do like Amistad.
Do you like Amistad?
I like Amistad. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's some movies that like are inspiring that aren't necessarily good films.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't.
I would actually put Amistad on that list.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a heavy, it's fine.
Yeah.
It's Spielberg doing Spielberg stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
That's all
yeah.
right. That's allowed.
Never uses a scalpel where he could use a chainsaw.
Have you seen Secrets and Lies, the Mike Leigh film?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That's my favorite Mike Leigh film, especially like at the end when you have the two sisters, half-sisters talking, and like there's all this sort of emotional pain that comes up with the truth coming out, all the different truths.
Mm-hmm.
But then like it sort of allows that relationship between the sisters to exist, and you know, when they say, oh, we'll just tell the truth, that's for the best, about us being sisters. Like, I find that really moving.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's movies like Gertrude I maybe appreciate on an intellectual level and don't find them all that moving. But then there are movies like The Passion of Joan of Arc.
And sometimes there's films where, like, people talk about them like they're, like, these super intellectual kind of things. And, like, my response is, like, not intellectual. It's very emotional. Like, like Paul Thomas Anderson's The Master. Like, I thought it was, like, a very delicate character arc about this person kind of getting control over his life, and I found that film very moving. And then people, the way they dissected it, I found it a little bit surprising. But
well, that's partially just how PTA fans function.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I guess because maybe people wanted to be moved by it but weren't, so they have to justify their own reaction.
And Lady P did not like that.
I like the movie. How dare you? The thing with the moving pictures is kind of subjective. Like, not everything moves everyone. So,
sure.
Network, I find that to be a very moving picture.
Interesting.
I love that movie. I love it too, but it's not a movie that I'm ever... I mean, I can be intellectual about it because I've seen it enough at this point, but it's a movie that I find to be horrifying and inspiring every time I watch it.
Inspiring is an interesting word.
It's probably part of the reason why I'm like interested in media is because I started watching this movie that was like, here's what media functions as right now. And I went, oh my gosh, are they right?
Well, there you go. Moved you to actually
action.
Yeah, exactly. Moved you to action.
Network, the unintentional Brechtian film.
Exactly. All right. I feel like that's a pretty good place
bringing
to stop.
Bring it back around.
Yes. All right. All right, let's compose ourselves and sign off with a few final notes of positivity. Anne-Marie, what's one book, movie, television show, article, piece of artwork, clothing, whatever you want?
Wait, we can do clothing because I have a lot of thoughts about shoes that I've never actually expressed on this show.
Keep that in mind for next time. We could probably have a separate podcast on this
about
topic.
Okay.
I feel like we could.
We'll
save it for later, though. Yeah. But what's a thing you like?
All right. So a couple of weeks ago, to very little fanfare, except on the Broadway Twitter, I guess you could call it, Lady Day at the Emerson Grill was released on HBO. It was it's called a straight play, but it's kind of a musical, performed in its entirety by Audra McDonald, who is, how to explain Audra McDonald? Audra McDonald has won literally every Tony Award you can win for acting, sometimes twice. She's won 6 Tony Awards total, and is a titan in theater. Unfortunately, she's made very little entry into TV and virtually none into film, so she's not very well known. But in theater, this particular play that she did, Lady Day at the Emerson Grill, she won Best Lead Actress in a Straight Play for it, and she plays Billie Holiday in one of her last performances at the Emerson Grill in Philadelphia. It's kind of showcased as she's singing the songs that Billie Holiday would sing along with doing this pretty much giant hour and a half monologue about her life and about going to jail and all of these things. And it's an incredible performance. It's one of those times where you're truly grateful that somebody decided to film this theatrical production, because these are the kind of performances that are ephemeral, that happen once in a lifetime and you never get to see. And the play itself is fairly heavy-handed, but Audra McDonald is able to replicate Billie Holiday's very specific sound and do it as if she is just extemporizing these notes. Like, manages to make it seem not like caricature, but true character. It's an incredible performance. I highly suggest you check it out. It would actually make a fantastic double feature with another movie that's currently on HBO right now, which is Bessie, the Bessie Smith biography by the director of Pariah, Dee Reese, and Queen Latifah, just because you would get about 3.5 hours of like early blues and jazz history. And on top of that, these are the kinds of performances and kinds of stories that you're seeing on TV about African-American women, about African-American singers, about queer women that are making it onto TV but not making it into film. So I would highly suggest it. I've been listening to Billie Holiday since then because I've always been a huge jazz fan, and it just made me go, you know what I need to do? I need to listen to Strange Fruit and cry alone in my apartment for a bit. So, Lady Day at the Emerson Grill.
Love it. Love it. It's on HBO. Mm-hmm. Is it streaming or you can get
it's
it on
HBO Go, which is how I watched it. I think they actually showed it on HBO, but I'm a millennial. Yes. I see all of my TV online.
Yes. Martin, what you got for us?
There's a horror film I liked recently. It's called The Witch, and it's... have you seen it?
Yes!
Okay. It's sort of like weird to go and see a horror film and be like, oh, I'm the target audience for this. And I like horror films that have period settings. I like very American horror films. And it reminded me actually a lot of Carl Dreyer's Day of Wrath.
I'm shaking my head vigorously.
I don't know like how much of it's influenced by Day of Wrath or how much of it's influenced by things that were influenced by Day of Wrath, like Antichrist or The Shining. But if you like that kind of horror film, I recommend people keep an eye out for it.
Okay.
That is the kind of movie where, in context, the line, "Didst thou have unholy congress with that goat," is terrifying. And then you walk out of the theater. You're like, I was scared by that line?
It's got like the best animal performance in a horror film since The Thing.
Black Phillip.
Black Phillip's great. "Wouldst thou like to live deliciously?" It's so good.
So good.
All right. Well, I'm going to bring the discourse down really low here. Get ready. I don't even want you looking at me right now.
No, I'm so curious.
I've been binge watching a program that I was fond of when I was in high school.
What is it?
It was called The OC.
Oh my gosh. Yes,
oh indeed. God. I'm sensing judgment.
No judgment.
Okay.
Absolutely not.
Okay. The interesting thing about this show is it's everything you expect. It's a nighttime soap opera, but nighttime teen soap opera. But it's also fascinating because it's this perfect time capsule of the early 20th century.
Early aughts.
Yeah, exactly. Or early 21st century. And while it feels to me like not a lot of time has passed, like The OC, that was like a few years ago, right? But actually, going back and rewatching it, it's terrifying how much has changed. It's actually really comforting how our attitudes about music and clothing and
sexuality,
bingo, yes, and gender roles and just like what we think of as an appropriate behavior for teenage boys, how much of has changed in those, I guess it's now been almost 10 years since that show went off the air, but it's actually comforting in that regard. And the things that I loved about it at the time, it turns out that those are awful. They're just truly terrible. Seth Cohen is a monster. I feel like I could do a whole podcast on the show.
I think your final note of positivity is that TV's horrible.
TV was horrible. And that's the way we frame it, flicks-wise, that is. Listeners, you've been working too much and not paying enough attention to us. So come say hello on our website, flickswise.com. And you can spend some time with us on Facebook, on our Facebook page at facebook.com/flickswise. And if you want to chat about your favorite movie pictures, or perhaps The OC, you can come find me on Twitter. The handle is @flickswise. But before you do all of that, the best way to prove your undying devotion is by rating us and leaving us a nice comment on iTunes. Seriously, we'd really appreciate it. Our next Sight and Sound entry is Abbas Kiarostami's Close Up. Until then, Ann Martin, I would quit my job for either of you, just so you know.
Our paths may be wandering. Thank you, Lady Pian. Farewell.
Goodbye. I'm waving at you from our cavernous cottage in Denmark.
This is where
Denmark.
You slam the door.
Yes.
Add us the door slam effect right here.
Yes.
All right. Bye, y'all.
Right. Apparently, when we get to Dallas, that's just a step too far. Yeah.
Well, I think Dallas is on the Sight and Sound list, right?
Yes.
Oh, definitely. It's right under it's right under that Laska Darn flick.
Yeah. Out one, then Dallas. I think out one might be a little longer though. So.
Oh my lord.